programming. So you're showing me the Cording keyboard that you had. When were you working on that?
Oh, I was in the 1960s someplace.
Okay.
But that idea actually stemmed from stories I would be telling my daughters when they were small. All kinds of stories, but one of my had to do with a picket fence. See, there's a picket fence, the pickets are up or down or something.
Yeah.
And about the funny old man that when he walked and he passed that picket fence, he couldn't resist changing every picket he came to. The only thing, he was so old, he had to lift one up. That tired him out and he went home. Mm-hmm. And then it just became so interesting. The girls would just watch every walk the guy took. And it was funny because the fingers all just change in this strange order. Mm-hmm. And so then finally I had them write a 1, a 2, a 4, an 8, and a 16 on the ends of their fingers, see. Mm-hmm. And then, Diana, you count them and tell me when they've gone to 7. See, by then it gets up like that. 1 plus 2 plus 4. How much does that add up? So then they got so fascinated. And then I said, you know what you can do? Is you can cheat in school. Because, you know, the twins were like this. So somebody says, hey, Diana, what's 21 divided by 7? Or divided by 3? And Christina, you could go like that. And no one would know.
It's like their own secret code.
Yep. So they just, they got so very like that. Then I wrote 1 to 26, A through Z. And says, now what's that? 7? No, look, you could call it a G. Mm-hmm. A, B, C, D, E. Boy, within about a week we were talking. It was just so much fun. That was a secret way that we could talk. And when the little girl's supposed to be in bed asleep, and mommy would get cranky because he hadn't gone to sleep, I could go in there and we could talk without any noise. See? And they just went out. So anyway, so one day, interacting with the computer things, and they're very, very early, I got to thinking, boy, while you're doing something this way, it'd be very handy if you had ways to type. So we built that, got it connected, and everybody laughed, but pretty soon everybody was using it.
So you taught them to, taught them sign language in base 2.
If they're computer guys anyway, that's the way the computer carries in its numbers.
Yeah. So you're saying you're still using, you still use it?
Every day.
Wow. Fantastic.
It might set up at the office. Here I...
Anyway. Awesome. So the talk that you're doing at MIT is going to be based around a concept that you've got out there called collective IQ. What do you define collective IQ as?
Well, it's if any collective body has a tough problem to sort of focus, how well do they get an understanding? How well do they sort of get oriented about the possible solutions, about the costs and the problems and the troubles for a different solutions approach, how they pick one of them, how as they go along they run into problems all the time, it's just very similar to the sort of the IQ for an individual. And the thing is that I think it'd be really interesting to start getting measures for given collective bodies.
Some sort of metric for collective IQ. Mm-hmm. Is anybody working on that currently?
I don't know what the people who are, several groups have started talking about collective intelligence. Mm-hmm. And I don't get it that they are talking about measurable levels. You know, it's the IQ, the quotient, the capability quotient.
Right.
So, anyway, when I get to MIT, I can ask more explicitly sort of what, whether they're thinking of measures or not.
Right. Is yeah, I wonder if it would be a measure of, you know, are you measuring what could be done or what could be known, or I mean, what are some of your thoughts on the ways that could be looked at?
Well, you mean what could be done to improve it or to measure it or what?
What could be accomplished through a certain level of collective IQ is kind of what I was thinking about down that way.
Well, it's say, hey, there's some myth coming up about global warming. See, so how long did it take collectively for the United States to sort of say, oh, all right, there is. See, but how long did it take to find, oh, what's the solution? Nobody is talking about the whole solution yet. They say, oh, we'll start taxing miles or things like that, but my gosh, the whole way it was moving, and it's just so much difference that'll have to be, and anyway, we're going to face the problem of the limited actual residual amount of oil that there is, which we'll be running out of in 20 years or something like that.
Yeah.
No one's talked about that. But anyway, just how do you rearrange the world? And there's just no way that's a simple answer.
Right.
You know, by putting a tax on.
Yeah. With that sort of path, with people being able to work and, I'm assuming, sort of combine their intelligence and their capabilities together. Do you think it will flatten out the way that markets work? One of the questions that we had come in was shortage of information among certain social groups has always meant a market was there. The, quote, ignorant pays to have something done, and that requires information that he or she doesn't have. That's why companies have IT departments and why most people have a number of different capabilities in their house. How different is the market going to be in a society where networking constantly increases the collective IQ, where individuals can kind of tap into that? Does that flatten out the gap between people who have explicit or unique knowledge or information and those who don't?
There's going to be a lot of dynamics, so I haven't really gone into it that detail. It's just saying, okay, it's going to be a real challenge to work at improving it. And then I come around to just finally realizing no one's smart enough to design the new status of it all, that then you have to facilitate the concurrent evolution of all of the parts of society and such to do so. It's more a evolutionary path that how do you encourage or facilitate it? And I've got ideas. The most explicit part of it comes to saying, well, we have to learn how to build effective dynamic knowledge repositories, and then what are the characteristics of those? Well, they have to gotten the knowledge gotten together, and the argumentative things about, you know, uncertainties, does this make this happen, or did that, was that the cause, or, you know, those have to be clearly marked fine by the relationship you established between the different protagonists, antagonists, doubters, arguers. And so then it also has to be something that is organized in a way that can be maximally effective as a learning, where you go to learn what the status is today, mm-hmm. situation.
Would you see the learning coming from sort of so if an individual wanted to learn something, would they be going to a central authoritative source? Would they be going to their peer network? Where would they be learning from?
Well, you have to have a central knowledge base. That's what you're collectively adhering to. And so maybe everybody doesn't agree, and so this, you want to keep the dynamics in a way in which they're maximally effective. And so you build, you know, have to be maximally effective at building all the pros and cons and agreements and everything. Just like what goes on in your head.
Right.
The more I looked at all that and made diagrams of the interrelationships between the processes and such, then I bump into, years later, what they show, the diagrams of the different brain functions. Gosh, it just, the similarity was just overwhelming.
Yep.
And so that made me really interested in different of those brain functions, you know, how you reason and rationale, etc. But the one kind of function that really gets me is called perceptual. And it's just hard to explain, but it's, you know, you look there and it's a cup. You know, but you just recognize it. What makes you recognize that that's a cup?
And you can turn it around and it's still a cup.
Yeah, but you know, you don't have to look at all the details and such as that at all. Just a person.
Right.
A girl, a boy. I mean, a man, a woman. Everybody's a kid.
Yeah, it's one of those things, you know, what, you know, when do four pieces of wood and a flat piece of wood, when does that cease to be a stack of wood and when does it become a chair?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when does that transition
right.
take place? And what's the difference between a chair and a stool?
No kidding, but it's the, you realize how far back in human evolution it probably was really a very important functional capability. You know, there's a rustle in the leaves over there. Boy, perception about what kind of a creature would be making that just instantly.
I was talking to the gentleman by the name of Caleb Chung a couple of weeks ago. He is most noted because he invented the Furby toy, which is a little kind of robotic toy, and he's working on a new sort of robotic toy type thing. But he was talking about a very similar thing. He's like, you know, when you're looking at things, how do you, you know, you're walking down a path, you're going for a walk in the woods, you see something on the path in front of you. Is it stick or is it snake? And what does your body do? Mm-hmm. And how important is it to be able to recognize that difference very, very quickly? And right. from an evolutionary point of view, is it important to be able to do that in a second or half second or a tenth of a second?
Well, it's goes down to some of the basics too. Is the different sounds coming from a guy? And they're separate words, but you don't, the separate words, you're just conveying the flow of meaning. And that's that perceptual machinery, just terrific. And visually too, you look around the room, you just accept it. So that's a capability that you have, and it's adaptable, that I feel like we don't recognize the potential value of. How can we harness that better? Because we've taken it for granted that the way a book presents knowledge is the way. That's a paradigm that's just hard to shake. But the computer has so many other ways that you could get trained that the viewing can be just much more flexibly adapted to the need of the moment. And the perceptual capability can do it.
So instead of a sort of a linear presentation of that information, something more, is it presenting the information in a different format, a different manner, a different order?
This is the what we were building in this NLS augment system. The very first thing we did was I said, well, I'd like to have you, if you go like this, what you see is everything collapses, all you see is the first line of every paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
and then you can, oh, I want to see that paragraph, and then when you jump to it, you can optionally open it up. So we built it like this, and it was such a kick because some of the young, you know, techie programmer guys, all of a sudden one of them was saying, "Geez, then that means you ought to start writing that. What's the first line in your paragraph gives you a best idea of what's in the paragraph." And he thought he'd invented something.
As opposed to, you know, fundamentals of grammar and essay writing.
So anyway, we just got more and more options for how it could look, so that it got so that people coming to watch how we worked, they would just, they'd go away saying it's so complicated. See? And if you just look at anybody operating anything today, you know, if somebody wasn't used to it, be that same way. So that sort of killed us. Everybody was saying it's too complex and hard to learn, but compared to the basic problem of challenge of learning how to read, it just was some extension to that.
Right.
But anyway, I wish we'd found some way that we could find the kind of people with the knowledge and background that could have done some tests, some meaningful tests. That would have helped a lot.
So you think one of the big challenges is really that ease of use and that simplicity of understanding how to interact?
Well, that's the kind of thing where somehow a strong belief seemed to be held that it's got to be easy to learn or it's not to be usable. And I just would say, well, how easy to learn was the alphabet in the first place and to speak?
Right.
But that just was taken for granted that you climbed that hill.
Right.
And so, and there are things like, boy, you know what a faux pas is. What was the grandest faux pas you could, I was invited to travel down, my way paid, etc., to New Orleans to the annual meeting of the Research Librarians of America. And they wanted to learn more about how computers were going to affect their librarians' work. And sure, they were assuming that, you know, the cataloging and the indexing and all of that. And I started telling them more about this kind of stuff, too. And I said, you know, it's just inevitable that books will become obsolete because the computers were going to show it up. This, and it's just like the audience evaporated or something. It's just they just stone silent, sitting still.
Because they were they're afraid that you were telling them that they too were going to become obsolete.
Well, their whole treasured, you know, profession was, what do they do then if there are no more books? Is that the only way, you know, the best way by far? So I still believe that and there's research studies I really want to get funded, get going, that can go like that. So the one that would be the most direct is just to say, look, they have automatically parsing programs, like Google makes huge use of that. And that takes the syntax of breaks down into that. So I say, hey, put those to work and then have it displayed. The different parts of speech are in different colors, you know, they consistently.
Right.
And I said that I'm just sure that this perception machinery, that it's only a matter of a relatively short time before, as you're reading it like that, you're taking advantage of that machinery is.
And there might be all sorts of different emerging or emergent capabilities that we have, that if we had those different types of stimuli.
Right. See, yeah. I think the machinery is there, that perceptual machinery is there, to start adapting to it. And it would be even, people wouldn't have to learn what the name of it is, what kind of phrase or something it is. it didn't matter to them because it's just in, like, you don't have to know all the words for the geometry of a cup to be able to get it. So I've been asking people here and there, you know, would they like to fund something like this? And I found linguist people that says, oh, that would be really fun to study.
Any takers yet?
No, I haven't got any money takers that were kind of... That's part of the problem. If you're off the paradigm base very far.
Do you think that's, looking at some of the things that you're working on, you know, with the keyboard and the mouse and such, do you think those things have had the transformative effect that you hoped? Have they achieved their potential, and have those, you know, those types of things that you're working on, have they gone as far as you hoped they would have?
No, I'd really like the features like what I call high resolution addressability, like something you could type or that would be in a link, for instance, that would be able to point to any word, any character, any object. That's what I want to talk about. Mm-hmm. And along with that link was a syntactic place where you could be the specification for the view when you got there, view spec. And so we just matter of course through that. So if you want to go there and it's just, hey, all you want to see that one paragraph, or maybe just the first three lines of it or something like this, that's what that link would do for you.
So being able to address anything at whatever level of granularity you need.
It just seemed to me that, and for some reason, this, that the guys who first started with their term for hypertext, and we were doing this high resolution stuff before anybody was even talking about it otherwise, but they just assumed clicking and saying that's the document, that's all they're pointing at. Mm-hmm. But that's what the academicians and such have been doing for years. You know, so-and-so says, and they would cite the article in the journal.
And it's a very coarse way of making that connection.
Yeah, but that's about all that was practical. But when you get a new technology, you can change your paradigms. Mm-hmm. So we were going like that. And there are other things too. You could have we had what I call inclusion or something, that you could have a jump. We had a name for it. Everything was optionally organized in a hierarchy if you wanted it to. So a node was any paragraph, any object in a given place. And a node and all of its substructure we call a branch. You know? And all of the adjacent substructures in a branch we call a plex. And then a group could be any successive set of these things. So we could just talk about it. So I want to copy that group. Mm-hmm. I don't have to click on these two nodes and it would designate the group. I want to copy that. And I could even just type in where I want it to go because the addressing was all applicable.
Right.
And so when I got that keyboard key theft going, boy, it just so powerful in how you can rearrange and move and jump. And I really wish there were somebody would start making a study and testing the kind of relative capabilities that it offers.
Right.
And then say, look, over the next 5 years or 10 years, or what almost anybody would say I expect to have in the profession still, how much value would it have to you if you could flexibly do that?
Right.
Well, is that value, does it warrant the cost, you know,
right,
of learning how to?
I mean, that's interesting. In that case, you start getting away from sort of the document metaphor and these big gross chunks of information and be able to get to the individual pieces, and then is what becomes interesting, sort of the networks of connections between all of the the individual pieces.
Right. So if you want to start making them explicit, which people are sort of implicit, as so-and-so said in that journal or something like that, boy, it's, then you can start doing things like keeping track of links. And so you look at a particular document and says, hey, I'd like to know how many people have linked into this. And then the other thing is, too, we had a syntactic place for saying that the purpose or the what kind of a link it was, link types, and whether I'm plus or minus four, I think that's something like this. And I'd like to know how many links to this document have negative. I mean, like this, 47? Oh, well, then let's start seeing where are they pointing, concentrating or something.
Right.
So that kind of, it's just right there to go after. No.
I mean, that would be, that's fantastic, because at that point you start getting a real assessment of what the collective group feels about that particular idea or document or author or product or what have you.
Or where the negatives come from. Categorizing, so you find it easy to categorize. Anyway, just the whole way of studying and getting understanding, it just opened up so much better, but it's hard to learn. So, one of my favorite photographs, I like to then ask them like this, it's hard to learn, huh? So, here was a guy with a helmet on, behind a windscreen like this, pedaling like crazy on a tricycle. And says, how often do you see that? See, that's the easy to learn. Anyway.
So, is it your feeling that to get to these levels of capability and opportunity, individuals will need to go over some sort of, need to go up that learning curve to be able to take advantage of them.
Yeah, it's like, what's there to obtain that's of value in society that doesn't have a cost associated with it?
Right.
And when has it ever been that this is what it ought to cost? If it costs more than that, who would drive a car today?
Right.
And I happened to get really interested in automobiles when I was 13 or 14. I found an old Model T that was a 1916 Model T Ford. It was such a beautiful relic. Found it in a barn.
Where was it? What part of the country?
I grew up in Oregon, outside of Portland.
Okay.
So, gee, no one knew who it was. Finally, I found who owned it. Paid $10, which would be quite a bit more now. Borrowed a neighbor's horse, towed it home, and kept the local country garage out there, the brothers who ran it. Since they knew I was a semi-orphan, etc., everybody in the community knows everything about everybody like that. So they just were real nice, and I'd come poking in. What are you doing there? Well, we have to replace this part of the engine. Well, that's what it is. And they'd stop and tell me all that. And then when I had this my own car, how do you put in the piston rings for this if you got to pull it out? Well, they'd show me, and then they'd loan me the tools, and I'd ride my bike home about a mile and a half, and then back with it right away. So anyway, I got really interested in automobiles and the history of how they evolved and when they came up and who could drive where and what. And so it was a massive cultural, social, economic transition that I came to be aware of reading about all that in there. And like the beliefs at the turn of the century, the last century. There was really, it's very solid things that women would never be able to drive. No way. I'm not going to get on the highway if you're going to let those damn women drive. And so, or that maximum speed that you think you could go to. Hey, beyond 30 miles an hour, I tell you, man.
Unsafe.
Yeah. So you see all of the social, technical, cultural things that have gone into the evolution of our transportation system.
It's interesting you bring that up, because it almost seems that we're having a round trip back to that sort of collective interest in actually making things and more tangible hands-on interaction rather than just pure virtual. So I mean, in the case of going out and figuring out how to pull the piston rings, how to build a cording keyboard out of of actual stuff, build a box from a box for a mouse out of a wooden case. I think it's interesting that we're starting to see this swing back to this idea of going out and actually doing tactical, tangible things is a trend. There's a big show coming up this weekend at the San Mateo County Fairgrounds called the Makers Fair. I don't know if you've heard about that, but yeah, a magazine started a couple of years ago of folks just taking making new things out of materials that they find around. And the first one last year was like 15,000 people, and this year is going to be something like 50,000 folks who are making robots and all sorts of different creations. Saw Steve Wozniak out there last year. He was on his Segway scooter playing polo. just all of these different ways of taking things that are in our environment and putting them together in new ways and making and creating something new and tangible that that wasn't there before. It's a real starting to see a throwback to a much more truer, almost hacker culture in some ways, which I think is pretty interesting. And that's a case where perhaps some folks are starting to come back around and realize that to make something or create something that is new and novel, there is an investment of time, there is an investment of creativity, there is an investment of taking that time to figure out what works and what doesn't. It's not something that's going to happen overnight.
Well, you guys are so incredibly young that it's hard to know how much change you've seen in society. but, if someone tried to describe 60 years ago, what it'd be like now, what you take for granted.
Yep.
Oh, hey, wait a minute. Anyway.
Yeah, the fact that, yeah, I mean, if I need to go to, London, okay, go to the airport, get a ticket.
And, yeah.
A few hours, half a day later, we're there. Whereas at that time it would have taken weeks.
Geez, that makes me remind me. I can actually remember the first airplanes we saw flying over our town. I hadn't thought of that problem. But anyway. Or automobiles. What I was interested in reading, like at the turn of the century, what people thought the maximum speed anybody could control a car, 30 miles an hour.
Right.
And absolutely, women, no way. I'm not going to let a woman drive a car.
Yeah, when you think about that, because just the order of magnitude from sort of what the frame was. I mean, if we walk at say, three miles an hour, let's say, and maybe maybe a horse can do 20 miles an hour or so, maybe a little faster. Car doing 30 miles an hour, that's 10 times faster than you could walk. Couldn't imagine going beyond that.
Or keeping control of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean that brings up a good point. I mean, go back to your perception points before. you know, the raw capabilities, the raw horsepower that we have to do things is, you know, I firmly believe, is so far away from being anywhere near tapped out, and that by throwing these kinds of challenges at the, you know, at the wetware we have, we get to find out where those limits are, if, you know, if there are limits at all. Because, you know, that thought of, you know, controlling a car at 30 miles an hour for someone who had never done it, or, you know, a population that had never done it, the thought of, oh, you know, I won't be able to think that quickly, I won't be able to react that quickly, and yet we have the, you know, we have the ability to do it.
Well, yeah. Well, I watched drivers. I got trapped one time in being too close behind somebody when they slammed on the brakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very watching of that now. Boy, I see guys that are just cutting in and out. If there's enough room to get in there, they'll go there. And one guy, I was invited to come down to UC Santa Cruz to get some talks to provide transportation. So this young guy came by and picked me up and took me down and get back. But boy, gosh, he would just cut in wherever there was space enough for it. He'd just dodge in there to get it. And the experience I'd had about not being able to stop, I just said, there's no possible way that if anything happened in that traffic thing where somebody, oops, you know, he wouldn't be able to control.
Yep.
You know? And yeah, he was one was up to have his test, his PhD, and they wouldn't accept him as a PhD candidate thing. I just watched still.
As the world gets faster, transportation gets faster, work gets more intense with Blackberries and constant internet access, I think people increasingly want a vacation, where instead of jetting there and doing 10 countries in 10 days, they just want to go in a canoe or a bicycle or even just walk and go into a cabin and don't do anything that resembles this modern high-paced life for like a week. Yeah. And that's what we call a vacation now.
Right.
Not even more high-paced kind of sightseeing of more and more stops. We just want to slow down. And I think that's a consequence of the massively, you know, over-intense world that we now live in.
Yeah.
That our vacations have to become slow.
Yeah, the vacation and the, you know, the things that we aspire to in that case are the things that you had to do 60 years ago.
Yeah, you want to go back, you know, to what you had 60 years ago, right?
Back to the future.
Yep, go back.
If you had an airship, I think people would take that today.
Yep.
Not the Concorde.
So, had a question come in actually from a gentleman by the name of Mark Resch, who actually shared a flight with you a few years ago, coming from somewhere in Asia. So you guys had a chance to sit together and chat for a few hours. And I guess that was right at the time where you were starting to work on is the Bootstrap Institute. Is that what you're working on? What has evolved with that since that time?
What, I don't know what time that was, but
it was, I think, just with the product within the last few years.
Well, that was an idea for how do we set up something where people could join and get enough movement going that we could start exploring in some significant way how these new ways of working and thinking such could be. And so that we could get people talking from around the country, and you know, they could join the institute, and then we would have meetings, etc. And that was really interesting. But it's so, as one woman though ever said at about the second meeting, I thought it was so successful for a whole bunch of people meeting, you know, from all around the country. And she said, well, now my boss has said we put in this much money and have it like this, so when is it you're going to do something for us? And, it really brought me down to earth. Then we got more into the realization that what was really needed is something that we call a NIC, and that was the evolution of talking about any organizations that have capabilities that they were trying to improve, and they found that there were others in the same way, they would form a society. That's what professional societies are, something like that. And we said, okay, that's an improvement community. So what if your improvement communities could actually start to be augmented in significant ways with network kind of capability? So we called that a networked improvement community, or a NIC. And so we just thought, hey, getting more and more, you know, ICs that realize that they'd be more effective at NICs. So that would be something where you have a common interest out there. And we actually then said, okay, well, that got interest. We had some meetings. And then came the idea that, well, let's see, suppose we got the NICs together to sort of what you call a meta-NIC, see, a NIC of NICs, and that one then could, that the common interest was the capability to collaboratively develop your common understanding, and doing it with the network kind of capabilities of the tool systems and things we had. So then we said, okay, let's. Then the term bootstrap grew way back there too. You ever heard the myth about where somebody was kept saying, God, I can't see over those trees or something like that? Oh, hey, well, here's what to do. Grab your bootstraps and lift yourself up. So that was a mythical story that I remember reading when I was about 14, and it just intrigued me so much, I think, so I never forgot it. So it's just sort of like, well, if what you do when you've got a NIC is, hey, why don't you get NICs early on that the common thing they're trying to do is get to be better NICs. See, so as fast as you learn how better to build your common knowledge repository and all the dynamics of that, hey, you turn that around to say, now I can use that same thing to be better at learning here. So the better I get at this particular pursuit, the better I'm going to get at making progress. See? So it's like this. So we call that bootstrapping, and that we realized then that if you could get, we call them, set up a bootstrap alliance, and actually a 501c3.
Okay.
It's still in existence, but the idea for that was that then its members would be improvement communities that wanted to get better, and they could join this as a common place to share the pursuit. And like, it's just so people that want to get better at curing a certain disease, you know, they pool the resources of the papers and have meetings, etc.
Right. It's, I mean, in that model, isn't it applicable pretty much in any pursuit, whether it's a technical pursuit or medical or, you know, gardening? It shouldn't. And the same fundamental idea of networking with other individuals with other experiences. Yeah.
So then the idea of how much the kind of tools and everything else in this augmentation scheme, that the early focus would be on how you get better at augmenting an improvement community. Mm-hmm. And especially the improvement community whose whole idea is how to get better at augmenting. So that Bootstrap Alliance is still there and has a board of directors and so on, but it just couldn't get either the salesmanship or the energy or the combination or something to build its membership and take off. Yeah. And I still think it would it's the best I can think of as a way to try to get society moving is that way.
So by connecting up with other peers who have similar goals and similar.
Well, actually cultivating and saying, look, purposely produce improving the way that your professional society could take most of them have repositories. And how do you make the repositories development and application and utilization a lot more dynamic and effective? So we just coined the term dynamic knowledge repository as a focus for that. How you get better and better at creating it and using it. Because that's what, in the end, any kind of collective IQ or something would mean. You have to have a knowledge repository that's dynamic. And what are the characteristics, you know, that you say, well, it's maximally effective that you can learn from it, can really isolate all the counter thrusts and hurdles like that and start working on those, that the argumentation on it can be more and more sort of like the equivalent of accounting, where you got rules of accounting, et cetera, go, and if you need to, you can get a CPA to go through and so I'm a certified public accountant, so hey, we need to call a certified public logician, so to speak, that's in there could go to say, look, your knowledge repository has got gaping things in it, and there's what you'll have to correct in order for to pass the test.
Do the knowledge audit, yeah, if you will. Go through.
And so how are you going to get, you know, it seemed to me that then the Bootstrap Alliance would be a perfect place for getting that to move. So I haven't been able to voice all these things in one package for how long now. So the only measure of success I'm going to lay on you for listening to this is suddenly you'll start publishing something that will electrify. Well, it is fun to ramble on about that, and it gives me a general feeling of personal depression, actually, to say, hey, I've been thinking and talking about this and writing about it for decades, and why the hell don't I get more momentum going, and what's my problem?
But do you think it's, you know, do you think it's your problem, or do you think it's an externality? Do you think it's elsewhere? Are there structural societal problems that prevent
some of these
ideas? Well,
of course, there's a strong tendency in a person to say, well, that's the problem. They don't do. but in the end, it's like saying, well, it's a communication challenge, and I'm not doing very much about it.
Well, Doug, describe what happened when you went into McDonnell Douglas. So remember the timeshare?
What's he talking about? One of my magic stories or something that she's remembering and I'm not?
Yeah. So when timeshare acquired Doug out of SRI.
After I got fired by SRI.
And they wanted Augment, which was at the time being used by about 1,000 people within the federal government. They loved it. People, decades later, still remember it as their peak technology experience. So timeshare got Doug, and they supported these 1,000 people. And as part of the process, did McDonnell Douglas acquire timeshare? What happened? Anyway, you got into McDonnell Douglas, yeah.
Then they, for some reason, they also were, they developed these computer-aided design systems that was so very effective at the time, and they talked themselves into setting up a business that way. So the business was in a corner of what timeshare was generally in the business about. So that's when it seemed to them very sensible to acquire timeshare to help facilitate their getting their computer-aided design stuff. And we just happened to be buried in the basement of the timeshare.
Then they took you out of the basement and they had you poke around McDonnell Douglas. And you started to realize that the knowledge problem was huge. That you had as many as 6,000 different businesses involved in creating an airline, building an aircraft. Do you remember this?
Yeah, well, I'll say.
You may have talked to a lot of people.
One of the friends I made there is still working there now. So he and his wife came by on a visit 2 months ago, and it was just, I was asking him, because he's now in charge of the computer support for a lot of the designing groups and everything. And, hey, if you could do this, would you do it? Oh, hey, boy, you know. But you had something else you wanted to say.
Well, you know, you went and talked to all of these people, and you said, what if you try to apply augmented online system for people to share all of this data? And they got very excited about it, and they wanted to do it. And so you really did make progress, because those people, this is 20 years ago, were dealing with kind of some of the issues that we're dealing with now when we're talking about coordinating through the internet. And they were just internally within McDonnell Douglas. And they needed to share information, they needed to look at the same diagrams, they needed their own views. The financial people wanted the financial view, the engineering people, the ordering people needed their view of the same thing. So the whole idea of the view specs and the links, being able to go into complex manuals, which are thousands and thousands of pages for each thing, and go to the exact place, not just be pointed to the chapter, was very important. And so they got very excited, and then IBM came in. Was it IBM? And they just said, oh, you can't do any of what Doug's talking about. And the whole project was thrown out. But imagine if that project had happened.
Yeah. Don't make me cry.
but it's a small thing like that, where one IBM salesman to get their commission on a deal prevented that kind of development of knowledge that would have changed how we do things today.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's another way of looking at it. I'm a green country boy that didn't know how to make a pitch or something.
But you're always saying about prevailing paradigms, and so it's not your fault. It's this idea of, you know, easy to use and whatever the day. I don't know what do you see as the most dangerous prevailing paradigms right now, besides the fact that people want it easy to use and natural learning.
Well, just take like if I say, hey. Reading and studying out of books will become obsolete. Boy, that just doesn't go over.
It's happening. The kids today, they are not reading and studying out of books as much as they used to.
Yeah. So then just to introduce the thing of the different view specs and ways of looking. And when will that... You know, because there's so paradigm is so much of, well, that's the way you read. It's sort of like if you come in and there are all your tools there, and you can only see them and look at them from this one angle viewpoint. You can't pick them up and look at them.
And Doug, even, I mean, this high resolution addressability went into video. This is years and years ago, but now with YouTube, people want to do this. You want to find that frame and that point in that frame that you want to refer to. You want to point to that. And that kind of linking, being able to link exactly to that, being able to view it. Supposing you were blind, your view would only be the voids. And you might have different tools that might say, okay, go forward, go backward, because you don't have the same visual metaphors that other people can use.
Right. So, any other final thoughts as we wrap? Any things that you'd really like to see people working on and charging ahead with?
Well, I think if we could get people start talking about capability clearly and explicitly, and sort of identify and name the capabilities that are there, like how quickly or effectively can you find out how this article this guy's written, what's the real difference between the two of them, or just basic things of how you study and learn and find out, and just say, okay, that's a capability that's important, and even get the idea of what the relative importance of the different capability components are. So I used to draw the diagram of a capability infrastructure thing. Well, just to start getting explicit about that would be very interesting. And then just sort of show how boosting these basic things down here would sort of compound into, you know, just really looking at capabilities. Anyway, I'd start doing it pretty soon. I'd get all carried away, and you know, that's what makes me feel guilty and incompetent. Because why haven't I been able to take these successive steps of clarifying these things?
Yeah, it seems that across the board, I think that's a general feeling of anyone who is entrepreneurial and optimistic, is that I've got all these great things. Why haven't they all occurred?
Oh, but what I'm saying here is, why haven't I been able to make it clear enough? So it's, a lot of smart people around. What's my problem?
Well, and Chris is saying it's the nature of the futurist that is always hitting a wall. And even you're saying it's the prevailing paradigms that is making you hit a wall. It's not, it's their blindness and your vision that is, seems to me.
I know, but still, you don't want to say there's no way that they could be brought to understand what you're saying. So then if this still doesn't understand, how do you help but feeling inadequate?
I think the learning process is a big part of what needs to go on with people. What you call evolution, I call learning, facilitating the learning. And so it can't happen spontaneously like evolution does. You've got to structure the learning path a bit more. So that's the path that I'm on.
Well, thank you very much for your time. Greatly, greatly appreciate it.
Well, okay, all you have to do is promise to go out there and get the world to start understanding so we can have some real discussions and arguments.
I will continue forging ahead.